Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2010, Eric Schmidt, then CEO of Google, had a vision for a personalized web. He said in a Wall Street Journal interview that one day, technology will be so good, it will be very hard for people to watch or consume something that has not, in some sense, been tailored for them. Of course, Schmidt was exactly right. Netflix, Pandora, Google News, etc. But according to Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein, that personalization, especially on social media, has also isolated us, polarized our political parties, and divided our democracy. Sunstein has a remedy for this. It's in his new book called Hashtag Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. And he joins us now. Professor Sunstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, of course, social media, fake news, all of this has been on top of mind for many people recently. But I'm just curious, how much of a threat, honestly, do you think all this is to the fundamentals of our democracy?
Significant. On a scale of 1 to 100, 63.
Wow. And I mean
not 90, but significant.
Higher than 50. And why? 50. Why do you think our democracy isn't resilient enough in the face of social media?
I think our democracy is very resilient. But if you go back to the founding, there's a lot of talk about Hamilton these days. And Hamilton's great contribution to kind of thinking about government was the jarring of parties and diversity of view can promote deliberation and circumspection. So America has really prospered when people who think lots of different things are talking to one another respectfully, in contact with each other, sometimes compromising, but always learning. And if you have a system where people are self-segregating into echo chambers of, you know, I like Senator Sanders and I think Donald Trump is fantastic, and those who disagree with me are, you know, very badly confused or maybe worse, then our ability to get along with each other and to come up with productive solutions will be significantly reduced.
Mm. Now, how do you see then this polarization being amplified further via social media?
Well, what we know is that if groups of people clump together with others who agree with them, three things happen. First, they get more confident. Second, they get more unified. And third, they get more extreme. And because on Facebook and Twitter, and I should say I use and like them both, it's really easy to clump with like-minded people, you know, to follow or just to read stuff that fits with your own preconceptions. You can get a really aggravated form of kinds of group polarization that have sometimes served democracies very poorly, where you get, in the worst cases, cults that are likely to consider violence, and in the less bad but also not good cases, where people are clumping together and thinking of their fellow citizens as traitors or enemies.
Mm. I'm curious, I mean, I want to get to some of your solutions here in just a minute, but how demonstrably different do you think this world that we live in via social media is now than it was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Because in a sense, you know, from the advent of cable television, we had the opportunity to immerse ourselves in the bubbles of our choosing.
You're right. It's not a radical break, but it is a difference in degree. So if you think of X number of years ago where there was a degree of nicheification, let's say, compared to 20 or 30 years before that, you still had a situation where on the outlet you chose, you'd get some topics that kind of serendipitously would come in front of your eyes. Or you get points of view sometimes on maybe you're watching a left of center station, but they're going to say some conservative things, and that will bring you up short, make you think something different. So what we have now with social media is more than at any time in human history, there's a capacity to create not serendipity, but control over your communications universe. you can live in a kind of cocoon, which is really cozy and pleasing, but which might turn out to be a prison.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons why I see this lack of serendipity, as you put it, being a particular problem in this day and age is that there are other forces, you know, offline forces in the United States that already make it harder for people to interact just in real life on a day-to-day basis with folks outside their immediate, you know, socioeconomic status, their preferred political party or viewpoint. I mean, there is polarization just within neighborhoods and how people live in the United States that's being further amplified by their online world.
You're completely right. So there's some research on geographical sorting where people used to be more mixed in terms of the political complexity, let's say, of their neighborhood. And now it may be that it's just uniform. It's all the Republicans together and all the Democrats together. We also see an increase in people's concern if it turned out that their child married someone of a different political party. So now a lot more Americans would be worried about someone marrying someone of a different political party than would be worried about someone marrying someone of a different race. Now, that's progress along one dimension.
Right.
Great progress.
Right.
People are okay with racial intermarriage. But it's not so good if a Republican family thinks, oh, my gosh, my daughter might marry a Democrat.
Yeah. Well, in your book, Hashtag Republic, you come back a few times to what I think is a very important area of worthy of exploration, and that is the tension between what we as individuals may want from our online world versus what is good for democracy, right? I mean, you talk about two different concepts of sovereignty, consumer versus political. Explain that.
Okay, so the great idea in a market economy is that consumers are sovereign in the sense that you can choose whatever you want, and you know, the company that sells sneakers or cell phones isn't sovereign over you in the sense that you can just say, no, I'm going to go elsewhere. And that idea values certain kind of norms. Usually, does this please me? Does that cell phone or that sneaker please me? The idea of citizen sovereignty is that we, the people, are in charge of our society. And as a consumer, you might think something. You know, you might say, as a consumer, I'm not going to buy a product, even though it's not good for endangered animals. I don't care so much about that as a consumer. But as a citizen, you might say, you know, an Endangered Species Act is a pretty good idea, and I'm going to support that. And I think the Silicon Valley conception of freedom, which, you know, captures a lot of the picture, just not all of it. The Silicon Valley conception of freedom is just consumer sovereignty, rather than thinking that we can kind of figure out together, so long as we respect liberty and such, what our society is going to look like. And that triggers some values and aspirations, which when we're going to the supermarket, we may not have foremost in our minds.
Mm-hmm. And so then how to remove those competing or lessen those competing forces if we're talking about enhancing the concept of citizenship or citizen sovereignty online?
Well, there are two kind of avenues. One is, let's just take Facebook as an example, and as I say, I'm a fan, but it has a news feed which really is the consumer sovereignty picture, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what do you want to see right now? That's for you. And there's a lot of good in that, but the news feed that is provided, let's say, by your favorite newspaper, and I'll say it right now, the Boston Globe, it's not just thinking, what do I personally want to see right now? It's thinking, you know, what's our responsibility as a newspaper? And that means that people see topics and points of view that maybe they didn't particularly want to see right then. And Facebook could go more in the direction, let's say, of a great newspaper or a great magazine or a great city, which just has serendipity in it. And if this seems kind of pie in the sky, it might not be, because Facebook has been talking publicly recently in a way that suggests it's reevaluating what it's going to conceive of its newsfeed as. Hmm. For each of us, it depends on what culture we live in, really. And whatever your political view, you might think, you know, I live in a society where half of the country is nuts, and thank goodness I'm going to not read that nuttiness. Or you could think that, you know, we're kind of all in this together, and as a great judge said in World War II, the spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure that it's right. and I have something to learn from a lot of different voices, and I won't know unless I kind of try to hear them.
Yeah. You know, Professor Sunstein, I think you make an excellent point here, but this is exactly why I have to be perfectly honest. I'm a little cynical about relying on companies like Facebook to evolve for the better good of their own accord. And it's not because I think anything nefarious is going on. It's just that we are dealing with very enormous, powerful companies that have to create shareholder value. And we know that in social media, the way to do that is to keep people engaged, right? That prize of engagement. And people stay engaged when they're served up with content that they like, that mirrors their world back to them. So it's a really, really powerful force in opposition to the serendipity that you're calling for.
Well, you have a point. And in the end, you know, it may be that the profit motive is a real challenge for those who seek more serendipity. But a couple points the other way. One is that if you look at the great companies, they have often found ways to promote a range of values consistent with maximizing shareholder value, which are less kind of short-term than you might think. So whether it's an automobile company that is trying to produce the safest automobiles on the market and more energy efficient than they were a decade ago, or whether it's a soft drink company that's moving, you know, maybe not as aggressively as some people would like, but which is definitely moving in the direction of more concern for public health, or whether it's a hospital that is concerned about money, but that's serving a lot of people who don't have a nickel, really. So the companies often have a diverse range of values. And the other point is that as much as human beings often like to clump together with people who think what they do, that can get really boring. To look in a mirror all the time, even if you like how you look, can get old. And so I think there's a lot of money to be had by appealing to that characteristic of our species, which probably most distinguishes us from other species, and that's curiosity.
Yeah. You know, you're one of the leaders of this idea of sort of nudge, or behavioral economics, right, where we can come up with sort of a less obvious ways to produce small ways to produce major changes in behaviors in people and systems. So I'm wondering what's the nudge solution here for democracy and social media?
Well, I think for social media to give people an opportunity to opt in to something that involves surprises or something involves opposing views would be a step forward. And what we've seen in the last few months even, it's really recent, is lots of technological whizzes devising stuff like this, where you can get an app which is freestanding, which will kind of measure whether you're seeing lots of different views, or whether you can get apps that will interact with Facebook to kind of show you what you're seeing and maybe provide you with stuff that's different from what you're seeing. So that's a direction. It's in the nature of a nudge. Facebook could provide something, you know, an opposing viewpoint button or a serendipity mm-hmm. button, or you'd even call it a Hamilton button. And I think we're going to see stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, just to plug a fellow WBUR reporter here, Asma Khalid, she's the head of our Bostonomics team. Just this week, she had a story about exactly this, about folks at MIT and Harvard who are coming up with Chrome plugins, for example, that can, one of them's called Flip Feed, where you see the Twitter feed from someone in another or a hypothetical person in another part of the country, different political perspectives, just to get sort of immersed in what their social media reality is like. And we will put a link to Asma's piece at our website, radioboston.org. But finally, Professor Sunstein, we're just sort of scratching the surface of what you have to offer here in your book. And I just want to, in the last couple seconds that we have, ask you, you write this very powerful sentence early in the book. You say, to date, social media have not helped produce civil war, but that day will probably come. Is that really the future that you foresee if we don't do something?
Well, I don't think in the United States we're going to see civil war, but it is probably the case that some sort of outbreak in violence will at some point or another be promoted by social media. And I don't think it's a large scale of civil war with a capital C, capital W, but But, you know, we've seen certainly uses of social media to promote terrorism. Our government's been very worried about that. Twitter and Facebook have themselves been very, very worried about that for recruitment of people and radicalization. Mm-hmm. So, basically social media are good, but so are cars and cell phones, and all three have downsides.
Well, Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School, and his new book is Hashtag Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. Professor Sunstein, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, in the last minute that we have, we started the hour at Fenway Park, and it was 0-0 at that time. And Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter, is there again with us now. We've got 30 seconds, Shira. Something amazing happened in the past 45 minutes.
Yeah, Andrew Benintendi, let me try to say that correctly because we'll be saying his name a lot in the future. He is a rookie, and he hit a 3-run homer in the bottom of the fifth, and the Red Sox are now ahead 5-0. So the crowd was going wild, I think in part because they were so eager to get some runs on the scoreboard, but also because they see Benintendi as the next great Red Sox superstar. He's already the preseason favorite to win the 2017 Rookie of the Year Award. He's only 22 years old,
yeah.
So he could be around and hitting home runs for quite some time in Fenway Park.
Well, I'm Twitter summing, he hit it off a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, too. Shira Springer, thanks so much.
Yes.
This is Radio Boston.
Thank you.